today on Against the Grain. What did the CIA do in the arena of literature? What did literary modernism have to do with colonialism? And how and why have private foundations actively collaborated with the CIA? I'm CS. Juliana Spar joins me to discuss her new book, Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The CIA was, of course, very active during the Cold War, but what doesn't receive much attention is the agency's activities in the realm of culture, including literature. The CIA, often through foundations that it set up or funded, championed certain writers and not others. It supported certain journals and not others. The CIA and its proxies arranged tours for certain authors and cultural productions to try to show, among other things, how tolerant the U.S. was in matters of race. In her new book, Juliana Spar considers the impact of politics on literature. She also links modernism and the avant-garde to what colonialism was doing to the colonizing powers. Juliana Spar is professor of English at Mills College and the author of 8 volumes of poetry. Her new book is Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. When Juliana joined me recently in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked her to describe the main project of her book.
Well, I was trying to figure something out. I'd gone to graduate school and kind of become a writer in the 1990s. And I kind of had this idea at the time that this literature was very politically important in some way. And then as time went by, I began to, it didn't feel like it fulfilled my kind of aspirational thoughts at the time. And I was trying to figure out why that was. And so it's sort of a question is like, why does literature in some way today not look like it looked in the 1970s or late 1960s, when it was really hooked into various kind of social and resistance movements, when political movements often set up places like cultural centers where they wanted to train people in how to write the literature, that they felt that the literature was an important part of their political project. And I was just trying to understand, like, what had changed and that was no longer true. And at the same time, we had this more and more very directly political literature being written. And it felt that contradiction kind of interested me.
I want to focus with you, and we agreed on this, on a chapter in your book, Du Bois's Telegram. And this focuses on, well, you begin the chapter by pointing to two traditions that define U.S. literature, or at least two traditions that you were taught about in graduate school. And let's start with new criticism. What is that?
It's a dominant form of U.S. poetry kind of in the 1930s forward. So it's Randall Jarrell, Alan Tate, Robert Penn Warren. And it's the idea that, you know, poetry, it's written in standard English, that it has unity and coherence in some way. And it kind of comes with this kind of form of reading, which sometimes gets called more colloquially close reading, which is probably what you're taught in high school and undergraduate English departments, which is to read a poem or a work of literature all on its own. So you don't refer necessarily to its politics in some form. And so they kind of come out, they kind of meet each other in Vanderbilt in the 1930s, and they kind of come together around this work that they publish, which is basically a defense of segregation, which they kind of present as a kind of agrarian politics in some way and a kind of defense of the South. You know, one of the readings of the reason why they're so like, just look at the poem, don't look at the politics, is that especially in this beginning moment, they have atrocious politics, basically. Mm. And so that some scholars read that as like a revision of them trying to kind of like cover up this kind of defenses of segregationist past in some way.
This is U.S.-based writers, writers based primarily, would you say, in the U.S. South?
Yeah, they all meet each other at Vanderbilt. And then they kind of like spread out, and like Tate goes and starts the creative writing program at Princeton, and a bunch of them go to Kenyon, and then they kind of like filter down, and they, I mean, they're they're primarily the people that are teaching creative writing and English, the writers in U.S. universities, which is one of the reasons why they become such a dominant force. But they also, you know, they're the poet laureates and they win the prizes. And they kind of have like a really defining impact. And a number of like the mid-century writers are people that were closely aligned with them, like Robert Lowell, for instance.
And when you say they went to, you said Kenyon, not Kenya, correct?
Yeah, Kenyon,
okay,
in Ohio.
Yeah. So the second literary tradition you refer to in this chapter is modernism. So how does or how were you told modernism differed from the new critical tradition?
I mean, well, I was taught that if the new critics were kind of like the national American tradition, that the modernists were something other than that, that they were kind of more internationalist, that they had an aesthetic that was built more around disjunction or juxtaposition, potentially more phrasal than kind of like unified.
Phrasal?
Like groups of phrases in some way. So like not necessarily this kind of like... Like you see that in Eliot a lot, like just putting like little phrases next to each other in this kind of juxtapositional, you know, like the forms that we call avant-garde or experimental, basically. And that those people like, you know, like, which is true, a lot of them met in Europe, mainly around Paris, and they used a lot of foreign languages in their work. And they were trying to be something else than this kind of like national U.S. or other nations' literary traditions in some way.
And what do we know about when modernism first emerged?
People argue differently. I mean, early 1900s, you know, sometimes Stein's Tinder Buttons is presented as the first work.
Gertrude Stein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gertrude Stein. And sometimes people are like, no, it was, you know, Marinetti and his Declaration of Futurism. And, you know, painters sometimes argue it's this exhibit that Roger Fry put together in 1910. But, you know, it's the early 20th century.
And Virginia Woolf, who you refer to in this book, said that on or about December 1910, human character changed. What did she mean by that?
When she talks about it in that essay mainly as there was an aesthetic change that happened. That suddenly there was people like Joyce and Eliot, and she even, in a phrase that I kind of love, she calls them window breakers, that they're going to kind of like go and, you know, destroy the conventions in some way was kind of like around that. And I mean, that's another kind of moment that she's kind of seen as like the arrival of modernism in some sense, that it was not going to maintain the kind of like the house of the nation in some form.
Who were the exemplary U.S. writers of modernism?
I think Stein. I mean, for a long time, it was defined by like Stein and Pound and Eliot. I think McKay is a really important figure that kind of, for a long time,
Claude McKay.
I put Langston Hughes there, although, you know, people would have a debate about it. But, you know, it's a big scene, and like it kind of, you know, like all of these kind of like literary scenes, you know, it kind of morphs into changes around mid-century and more people, you know, there's a kind of through line basically that happens.
So modernism was seen, may still be seen as a kind of aesthetic revolution, and that those aesthetics were original, that they represented kind of a radical break from what had come before. What do you think of that?
I mean, I think it was primarily an aesthetic revolution. I mean, I was kind of taught in graduate school that it was also one, like, a political revolution in some way. And some modernists did have better politics than the new critics. Some did not. But it didn't have the same, I mean, it doesn't have that same history where they kind of meet around a kind of political position in the way that the new critics did. Yeah, I think it was primarily an aesthetic revolution. I think that's the only meaningful way to understand it.
And what's your argument in this book about what modernism's relationship was to colonialism, to the colonialism that European powers, of course, were engaged in, and the kind of colonial cultures that might have started coming back to the metropole, started coming back to the colonizing powers?
I mean, I think it makes the most sense to think of modernism as very, very much shaped by not just colonialism, but by colonial cultures. And that's been easy to recognize for people that are working in painting, for instance, in part because, you know, there's all that work around Picasso. It was very clearly painting, or the things that we recognize as cubism was very clearly coming out of these attempts to kind of like allude to, mimic, some people would say steal and appropriate, the kind of aesthetics that he was seeing in African sculpture that was becoming, people in Europe were becoming aware of it because of colonialism. And, you know, and then there's often a reading that Stein is like a literary form of cubism, which doesn't go back and think about, does that mean that we think about Stein in relationship to colonialism? And she's traditionally not been thought that way, but I think it actually probably is one of the meaningful ways to kind of think of that work. Although I don't think that Stein was an anti-colonial writer by any means. She doesn't really, I mean, she kind of talks a little bit about like these big political changes that were happening, but not a huge amount. I mean, the other way that that's been understood, that relationship, is it's often said that, you know, there was surrealism and then that formed negritude, you know, which would be like Aimé Césaire and figures like that that were coming out of Martinique. The writers coming out of Martinique are often seen as influenced by surrealism. But Césaire's wife, Suzanne Césaire, has this really kind of interesting argument where she's like, what happened was is that surrealism was taking for us and we were merely, you know, we were reclaiming in that moment. And that's why it looks like we took it from surrealism, but, you know, it's actually a more complicated lineage again.
Her name is Juliana Spahr. She's professor of English at Mills College, and her new book is Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. It's published by Harvard University Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So what other writers and artists were shaped by the aesthetic forms and concerns of the colonies, coming from the colonies?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would probably want to read most of literature as having to think through what it meant. I mean, there was colonialism. In terms of literary culture, we've tended to read it as European culture went out into the colonies and shaped the colonies, which I think is true. That was at moments a very malevolent shaping, you know, took the form of kind of like flooding the colonies with, you know, books in English literature and changing language practices. But at the same time, you know, once those connections happen, you know, a lot of people from the colonies were coming into Europe, and that also shaped, you know, how we understand basically all of Europe in the same time. It was a two-way street. It was an uneven power relationship for sure. But it doesn't make any sense, I think, to think of any sort of European culture after colonialism as purely European or American as purely American.
Hmm. So you referred earlier to Aimé Césaire, and anti-colonial writers are pretty prominent in at least this chapter of your book, Du Bois's Telegram. What did writers like Césaire say about the role that culture plays in liberation movements and movements that push for or could push for self-determination in these countries?
I mean, Césaire thought that poetry was really important. I think probably in a way that I might often find a little at moments optimistic, you know, but he's kind of like, I mean, he has that great phrase that I'm going to butcher it in some way about, you know, like poetry is like bread, you know, how crucial it is to like this revolutionary moment. And definitely like literature and other forms of art, dance among them, has played like a really important role in anti-colonial movements in the 1950s and 1960s. It was seen as one of the arenas in which there would be both resistance to colonialism and also once decolonization happened, there's a kind of an awareness among a lot of these major figures, many of whom were writers, like Césaire goes on to play as, you know, a significant role in Martinican governmental politics, you know, that literature is important to kind of like forming a nation. Like they're kind of really aware that it, you know, it kind of brings people together and it kind of sets up a national culture. And so they have a lot of kind of, it's another moment where like there's a call to produce literature that will do this work.
And how concerned were colonizing powers with this idea, this reality maybe, that culture could play such a radical or radicalizing role in the colonies, that culture and writing and art could foment, could fuel a revolution?
They're concerned. I mean, there's two kind of different main histories there. I mean, there's the French one and then there's the United States one, and they're slightly different. But I mean, the United States is very concerned and, you know, puts a lot of money into cultural production and manipulating cultural production after World War II. The Soviet Union is also very interested in it and very concerned with it, you know, sees it as one of the forms the Cold War took was a kind of cultural war. France and the United States are both concerned about the moments when literature and communism come together, and they put a lot of attention into that.
And what about efforts to, well, you referred earlier to this project of, maybe you could call it imposing the colonizer's language on the colonized. How was that done? Like, through what venues, political or cultural, were, let's say, the English language or the French language imposed on their respective colonies?
It varies. These places all have these kind of very individual and often unique histories. At moments, it would be outlawed. At other moments, it would be like suddenly, like, you know, all the governmental discussions in a language, a certain language, all the education, you know, all the newspapers and things like that at various moments. So it kind of depends on the various locations and kind of their history with it. I mean, one of the more kind of interesting examples of this that's less like legally mandated is the, you know, the United States became really interested in, there was a kind of a sense of like looking at what had happened in this French Africa, in which there had been a kind of the literature of resistance that came out of that was often, you know, often went through Paris in various forms. So the United States kind of does a thing where they're going to create a literature and English in Africa that kind of didn't exist prior to the moment of the kind of CIA going in and kind of establishing these cultural centers and, you know, funding publications and, you know, doing a whole kind of range of kind of cultivate. They hold huge conferences and, you know, invite African writers over and support them in many ways.
Yeah, and I think here we get into the activities of both the CIA and the Congress for Cultural Freedom. What was the Congress for Cultural Freedom?
It's a private foundation that was basically a CIA front group. After the war, World War II, the CIA, in this moment in which they decide they want to put a lot of money into cultural production, but their argument is that they're not the Soviet Union. Like, the Soviet Union's doing this and they're kind of like mandating that writers write a certain way, that, you know, eventually they start off at this early avant-garde moment and then they eventually like solidify around socialist realism. And they're like, this is the language of the proletariat or the literature of the proletariat. It should be written by the proletariat. And the United States in response says, well, what we have to offer is freedom to writers. We offer them freedom and autonomy. But of course, like, they wanted to, you know, manipulate it as much as they could because they had this idea that it mattered. And so they established a series of kind of like foundations, which would let them kind of put the money through these foundations. And they often worked with pre-existing foundations. The Ford and Rockefeller foundations play a really significant role in this. But, you know, there's a number of them. But one, the main thing that the CIA funds is this Congress for Cultural Freedom. And they... they're a huge organization. They have many branches. There's many branches in Africa. There's many branches in South America. They fund, there's some in Asia. They fund a huge amount of projects. I mean, I don't know whether we'll ever know how much money was put into it, but it was not insignificant. I mean, I suspect it's probably by far the largest amount of funding that the U.S. government has put into kind of like arts and culture.
You're right that the Congress for Cultural Freedom was established in 1950. And it was active for 17 years. Who were some of the higher profile U.S. writers who benefited from the nation's, the U.S.'s cultural diplomacy program, from CIA and Congress for Cultural Freedom activity?
I mean, most people, I mean, Faulkner is a huge one, which I actually don't even talk about in this book. But he worked for them for like a really long time. I mean, it's all, if you read this, there's this really good book by Frances Stoner Saunders, and she goes through it, and it's almost like almost every mid-century writer feels like it's they've been touched in some way by this, you know, CCF foundation in some form. And so, like, you know, it's everyone from A.J. Ayres to Julia Child to, like, you know, a million writers kind of in between. You know, if you go back and look at the archives, there's a lot of writers that are kind of like trying to, you know, understand it. There's some sense of like that it is governmental money, that it is CIA money, is kind of like something that they seem to be talking about at moments. You know, when it finally gets exposed, everyone's like, I didn't know. And it's, you know, it's unclear. There's a lot of people that said, of course they knew. Of course, everyone knew. You know, it's kind of hard. Like, you know, like there's been a lot of like attempts to kind of go through the archives on these projects. But, you know, like any kind of governmental project that's set up around, you know, deceit, it's, you know, like the archives are complicated.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Juliana Spahr joins me in studio, S-P-A-H-R. She teaches English at Mills College. She's the author of 8 volumes of poetry, including That Winter the Wolf Came, Well Then, There Now, and Response. And we are talking about her new book. It's called Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. And when we talk about U.S. writers benefiting, or any writers benefiting from Congress for Cultural Freedom activities, are we talking about remuneration? Are we talking about publication in certain journals? Are we talking about invitations to conferences that gave them higher visibility?
Yes, all of that and more. the Congress published books. The Congress funded writers to go to certain locations to meet other writers. It funded a lot of translations. It funded journals. It often would offer these writers like these multiple venues. So like, you know, you can sometimes see them picking up an article and it'll be published, you know, simultaneously in 4 different languages. You know, James Baldwin, Everybody's Protest Novel is an early article that they're really interested in. That, you know, I think it appears in French and German and English, like, you know, like in short order.
What did Baldwin argue in that article?
I mean, it's a kind of, it's an attack on a political novel, and which is one of the reasons why I think that the CIA and these networks was particularly interested in it. You know, he kind of argues that, you know, the political novel's trite and, you know, overly simplistic.
So in other words, literature should not address politics?
I'm trying to remember if it goes that far, but it definitely is like Uncle Tom's Cabin Sucks. I mean, it's a position. This is early Baldwin. There's early Baldwin and there's a late Baldwin. And, you know, early Baldwin wasn't particularly interested in the connection between literature and politics.
And do you think he knew? I mean, did he know that what he was writing was being used by the U.S. government to propagate opinions that, you know, matched the concerns of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the CIA?
I don't know how much he knew. I'm not a very knowledgeable Baldwin scholar in terms of the biography, and so it's unclear to me. He circulated in these networks for a really long time. And I mean, I think like many writers, he, you know, like this early moment in which he's kind of skeptical of a lot of this kind of like anti-colonial literature, what, you know, his concerns overlap the CIA's, and they really love left figures that kind of are skeptical of communism in some way. And they put a lot of their funding into that particular type of figure in those years. You know, like the story that gets told about him is that, you know, he comes later in life to this kind of political awareness, and he ends his life by claiming that he's writing this, you know, tell-all about the FBI that never kind of gets published, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of archival evidence that it was in any way done. But so he does have an awareness, certainly by the end of his life.
Yeah, and you make clear in your book, you're not taking away from what he said that was anti-government, that was provocative in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to. I mean, if I had anything that sometimes feels to me like we misunderstand is just how complicated these moments are in some sense. That we often tell this other story of Baldwin, right? That Baldwin was haunted by the FBI, that there's a large file on him, which makes him, presents him as this kind of like, you know, person of purely of resistance in some way to these networks, which he wasn't. And one of the things that's been kind of interesting to me is like how many of these writers, even as they were working with the FBI or the CIA or the FBI was maintaining large files on them at the same time. And there's a certain way in which it might make sense. Like if you're, you know, working with these writers, you want to know what they're up to. But we tend to, we've had a tendency to read them purely as kind of like resistance figures when they had more complicated relationships. There's that movie that came out, that Baldwin movie, the documentary. And it actually, I was kind of fascinated in it because he had a film that technically shouldn't be shown in the United States because it was propaganda produced by the USIA around Baldwin talking about the March on Washington. And they were presenting it again as like Baldwin as this resistance hero. But it was a moment when he's actually making a film for, you know, U.S. cultural diplomacy that's made to be shown kind of in the Soviet Union to talk about how, you know, like the U.S., despite the March on Washington, you know, has a kind of inclusive racial politics in some form.
USIA, U.S. Information Agency, right?
Yes.
So the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was, again, as you said, a front group for the CIA, it at some point chose to present a play by Gertrude Stein called Four Saints in Three Acts in the year 1952. Before we get to that, can you talk a little bit more about Gertrude Stein? I know Tender Buttons, her book of poetry, is very important to you. What was so striking about it and its language?
The book Tender Buttons by Gertrude Stein, it's very fragmented, and it seems to be potentially a description of a domestic space that doesn't use any of the kind of like realist conventions. It uses a kind of very atypical language, and it's been heralded as the beginnings of modernism, or especially of avant-garde or the more extreme forms of modernism. And Stein wrote it early in her life, and she's got this very, you know, like many of these, you know, people that lived through this, you know, World War II, she's got this very complicated political life. You know, she kind of becomes way more nationalist after World War II in some form. But she's always writing this kind of avant-garde. She writes a mixture of avant-garde stuff and kind of like other stuff that's like a little more kind of like memoirs about the war and stuff like that, that's a little more conventional. And she has this play called Four Saints in Three Acts that was one of her more experimental pieces. You know, it's very fragmented. It's got a bunch of saints in it. It's unclear what actually is happening in it. You can impose these various stories about its concerns, but it's mainly like a lot of language. And it was produced as a play. And, you know, early on, it had this kind of like novelty of this kind of like all black cast. And it doesn't seem to, as best I can figure out, when it was first produced, have been that for any more than a kind of like, I don't even know what the right word would be. Like, you know, it seemed fairly apolitical. It was a kind of like spectacle, probably more than anything else. But again, like this, the U.S. government became interested in it because it had an all-black cast. And the Soviet Union at the time, a lot of their cultural diplomacy was talking about how the United States was very racist and how, you know, the black citizens weren't allowed to, you know, circulate freely. And there was a lot of issues around race in the United States. And so they were really interested in touring, in particular, black cultural production. However, in a move that seems, I think, weird to us now that you would put forward a Gertrude Stein play as an example of this, they, you know, that play was one of the things that they kind of like toured. They did a big European tour of it. Porgy and Bess is the other one that kind of is circulating a lot in this time, which is another kind of, I think, play that seems odd to us as a, you know, but it also has an all-black cast, you know, and it was used as kind of like how, again, like the United States' tolerance towards, you know, cultural production that, you know, looks at poverty in some form.
How about black writers that the State Department and other organs of the U.S. government put on tour? Which black writers were invited to participate? Where did they go?
You know, a huge amount. I can't, you know, I'm hesitant to say that it was disproportional in comparison to like other races, or mainly I would say, I guess, white, because they didn't actually tour that much Asian American lit, as far as I can tell. Although there were, again, like CCF networks in various, you know, Asian countries. Hughes is actually, you know, giving a talk at gives a talk at one of the Congress of Cultural Freedom organized conferences in Africa, one of the conferences in English literature. But, you know, Hughes didn't really work with them that much. Richard Wright has a very long and complicated relationship with them. And I kind of think of like Baldwin as kind of a writer who starts off in these CIA networks. Like most of his early publications are in these various journals that are funded or founded or infiltrated in some way by the CIA. And then, you know, by the end of his life has, you know, very angry at the government in various forms and kind of declaiming, trying to separate himself from that relationship. Wright has the, you know, the opposite trajectory, which is that he starts off as a communist and then has this break with the Communist Party and then becomes very, very right wing and, works very closely with these CCF networks for, you know, a long time and kind of like goes to various moments to like the U.S. consulate and tells them, you know, that, you know, like Du Bois has been invited to a conference, you know, don't let Du Bois go because he's too far to the left. And, you know, Paul Robeson, he also, you know, says like, you know, he gets the U.S. government to say that this group called Presence Africaine, that they shouldn't work with Paul Robeson either. So he kind of goes the other way. He goes deeper in.
Juliana Spar, English professor at Mills College, and her new book is Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. We'll take a short break and speak more with Juliana about her very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Juliana Spar, S-P-A-H-R, teaches English at Mills College, and she co-edited with Claudia Rankine the volume American Women Poets in the 21st Century. And we are talking about her book, Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. It's just out from Harvard University Press. Can you talk more about this alliance between the CIA and private foundations in the U.S.? I think you write that over 170 foundations, including the Ford and Rockefeller foundations, were involved. So is this a funding of the foundations? Are these other kinds of links between the CIA and these foundations?
Foundations... major foundations have long had very close ties to the U.S. government, and they're this weird American thing, you know, that they're formed basically for these very rich people to avoid having to put all their money into taxes. And so they get to instead put their money into this foundation, which they can kind of then put however they want. And it doesn't have to go into, you know, getting poor people food and health insurance and stuff like that. It can instead go into cultural production. so they kind of from the very beginning have had the same staff. And that relationship continues to today. Like often you'll look at people that are directing these foundations and they've been working for the State Department. They've been working in various parts of the government. So there's already a kind of natural alliance between these two organizations. They share staff. They're always in dialogue. They're on the same, you know, they're at the same cocktail parties and that kind of stuff. And so during the post-war period, when there's this kind of sense that, you know, that cultural production matters and that it needs to be funded, and those networks kind of get more robust in some sense. And the CIA will often give money directly to these foundations with the idea that the foundations can, you know, assign it and it doesn't look like CIA money.
And did the CIA sometimes create or found foundations?
Yeah, they founded a number of foundations. I don't know the exact number, but yes, many.
And these foundations weren't, of course, necessarily upfront about the fact that they were funded or created by national security agencies.
No.
And you said earlier that there was an infiltration of journals, of specifically journals, by the Congress for Cultural Freedom and therefore the CIA. Can you talk about that? I mean, what was the extent of that activity in the 1950s and 60s?
It varied. Again, like anything, it had a lot of different forms that it took. At moments, the Congress for Cultural Freedom would actually, you know, found magazines. And they did this, you know, internationally a lot. So they would often be like, there's like a magazine for the Germans, and there's a magazine for, you know, various South American countries. And they would, again, like present this kind of like culture and debate and that. So that's one form that it took. It sometimes took the form of like buying out runs of magazines. And that's the kind of more kind of benevolent form. Like they would often buy a lot of copies, say, of the Kenyon Review and distribute it through embassies. And they did that from a lot of like mid-century, you know, literary magazines. And then sometimes they would fund things through their various networks. You know, the most interesting kind of example here is the Paris Review, which was founded by Peter Matheson, as a kind of a cover story for his being a CIA agent. Like he would go and, you know, kind of circulate as a magazine editor instead of a CIA agent. You know, so that's the kind of, you know, and they often, like the CIA funded a lot of parts of the Paris Review for a long time, like supplemented editor salaries and like were part of the dialogue about like what sorts of editors should be of the Paris Review in various forms.
Did they shape the editorial decision making of the Paris Review and other journals?
I mean, that's a big debate. There's some isolated examples in the archives of there being kind of content being shaped. A lot of people that added that got these funds when it was kind of exposed in the 1960s, they would say like, well, they just gave us the money and there was no pressure of any form. But I mean, they were giving the money to journals that they felt had politics that were, you know, very similar to theirs, although they were at moments seeming to kind of like infiltrate more kind of left socialist magazines in particular. And I mean, when I look at them, it feels to me like it did change the content, although I suppose they could have gone more, you know, more to the right on their own. I mean, that might have felt like a natural trajectory to those editors at various moments. I kind of keep hoping that someone will do a kind of like, you know, big data study of like what these journals do, or, you know, at these moments, and like how do they differ from some of these what often get called like the liberation journals.
Yeah, what were some of the left socialist journals that were infiltrated or funded by the CIA?
The Partisan Review is one of them, and the Ford Foundation establishes this one called Perspectives USA that was edited by James Laughlin. Oh, that New Leader was another one that got a lot of funding that, again, becomes more conservative as time goes on.
Yeah, The New Leader, I'm just reading from your book here, begun in 1924 as a socialist magazine. Partisan Review, begun in 1934 as an official Communist Party USA journal, although it quickly dissociated itself from the Communist Party USA. So these are left-leaning journals, as you say, that the CIA wanted to somehow support and influence in a way perhaps to draw lefties away from some of the other leftist journals?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And also to, you know, amplify, you know, certain concerns that I think are closer to their politics. You know, that Partisan Review example is kind of interesting because, it has that, you know, like they start with the CPUSA, they break with it probably on their own. And, you know, a lot of people were breaking with communism at that moment. In the Soviet Union, things weren't going well. And then they become, you know, part of the kind of like left, unaffiliated left in a certain form, which is, again, the sweet spot that the CIA in particular is kind of interested. It's really interested in anti-communist leftists.
Juliana Spahr joins me in studio. She is professor of English at Mills College in Oakland, and she is the author of Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you have these journals founded and or supported by the CIA, by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, And you, I think you said earlier, you know, that a lot of these articles that were published in some of these journals were translated into different languages and maybe reprinted in other journals in the Congress for Cultural Freedom Network. How influential were these journals and the networks in terms of determining who was considered a major writer in the U.S., who was to become, say, part of the U.S. literary canon?
I mean, we'll never know because it would require a revisionist history. I really feel, I mean, I feel like it had a major impact, which is one of the things that I kind of like began to try to figure out when I started the studies, because I have a belief that it did matter. And, you know, when you look at some of the magazines that were, you know, like published a lot of leftist writers, the ones that, you know, stayed communist or stayed leftist and didn't circulate in those networks have kind of disappeared. I suppose you could argue that they weren't as good of writers. I'm not really convinced by that. But the fact that so many major American writers, or the major American writers that we know of as major American writers, went through these networks seems to me very telling that they had a very significant impact. And I'm kind of convinced that, you know, like, I mean, Baldwin, again, is an interesting figure in this. Like, I'm not sure that we would know of Baldwin if Baldwin had not already kind of gotten this really big megaphone through these CIA networks. And he kind of, again, like, interestingly, is using that megaphone at the end of his life kind of against these networks. But I feel like he would have probably be someone that would have potentially been a much more minor figure in American literature.
How do we account for the question of agency, of writers doing their thing, of having control over, to a large degree, over what they're doing? You quote one historian as saying that the CIA could not always predict or control the actions of the writers it secretly patronized. So how do we take into account the independence that, to some degree, all writers exerted?
Yeah, that's a hard one that I've been trying to kind of like figure out if there's any kind of meaningful metrics by which we could, you know, establish for sure what that means. I mean, I think that writers maintain their autonomy. And I think it's true that, you know, like there's many, many examples of, you know, Faulkner being uncontainable while on his CIA sponsored tour, you know, very drunk and causing trouble. However, I've been unwilling to kind of see these stories as a sign that these networks haven't shaped things in some way. I think a lot of the writers probably felt that they were doing, you know, whatever they wanted to write. But sometimes if you look at their kind of careers, it's like you'll see them. I mean, Langston Hughes is kind of an interesting example of this. Like, you know, his early really left poems are, you know, written around, you know, the 1920s. And by the time he starts to kind of get some sort of like funding, at various moments, he's writing much less incendiary material. He was also, you know, very much caught up in the Red Scare. So, I mean, that probably also had a chilling effect on it. You know, McKay's kind of another one whose work kind of follows that trajectory. And I'm sure that they felt like they were writing what they wanted to be writing at that moment. But, you know, at the same time, I kind of feel like you may think that you're writing what you want to be writing because you're financially, you need money or some form.
Yeah, sure. So, right, there might be some self-regulation, even some self-censorship. What about the censorship, you know, the actual suppression of content that the Congress for Cultural Freedom, through its journals, was effecting? Do we know how much content was actually suppressed?
No, and I don't know whether we're ever going to know. Again, like, we have these isolated stories, you know, a story about a John Berger book that was going to be published by the same publisher that published Encounter, which is a kind of interesting journal that was half CIA, half whatever the British equivalent is. and stories like that, or like, an individual article was kind of like put down in some, you know, around on China, wasn't allowed to be published. I mean, it's just really hard to kind of figure out the extent of it. And I mean, a lot of the people, again, that are funded are people that are not, you know, that are already within the party, within saying the right things.
Yeah, in fact, if you carefully vet the people that you're going to work with, then maybe you really don't have to do much censorship because you know what they're going to write and say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, there would be no need to censor, you know, Matheson's editing of the Paris Review, for instance.
You referred much earlier this hour to the CIA and what it did with English language literature in Africa. So what was the agenda there, and how did the CIA and the Congress for Cultural Freedom carry it out?
I mean, the way I would tell the story is that, you know, the CIA is concerned about these decolonization movements, or the U.S. government's concerned about these decolonization movements happening in Africa and their ties to communism. They're hesitant to be openly involved in them. So, I mean, one of the things, the forms that it takes is, again, the establishment of a lot of, like, cultural centers that support the writing of literature in English, and the development of a kind of intellectual elite. You know, like the belief in soft diplomacy or cultural diplomacy is that it will create this kind of like, you know, intelligentsia that will, you know, stabilize the country in some way. And that's their kind of like, you know, the things that they say when they talk about it amongst themselves. And they funded at least two pretty significant magazines that we know of. I mean, we know they were funding more, but one of them is a journal called Black Orpheus, and another is a journal called Transition. You know, like, again, like, both the editors have claimed that they didn't know that it was CIA money. They may not have known, but they both came out of these kind of like cultural center networks and established these English language magazines. The most interesting one is Black Orpheus, just because this guy who edited, this guy named Uli Bear, was kind of like a colorful figure in some sense. And when he starts Black Orpheus, which he, you know, he was like, wants to cultivate literature and English in Africa is his desire. He's a German immigrant.
Living in Nigeria, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he starts it with this grant from the Nigerian government. And then within a year, he's getting Congress for Cultural Freedom funds to do it. And he ends up, because there's not a lot of literature written in English at the time, he writes a lot of the articles under under fake African names, you know, which it's just kind of bizarre in this moment to kind of begin to think about it. You know, again, there's a lot of like, I don't think there's been a big study of him. And a lot of people have like, you know, he's been like, oh, I didn't know. But, then, you know, after he leaves Nigeria, he goes to Papua New Guinea and kind of does the exact same thing there.
And this focus on English language literature and promoting it in, for example, Africa, this was about seeing languages that weren't English, languages that were indigenous, as potential threats?
I think seeing literature, yeah, as a potential threat, and that if you could develop a kind of intelligentsia, you know, or a literary culture that was in the language of, you know, the United States in some form, that that they would be friendly and there would be ties and that they would take on the concerns that were similar to the concerns that the United States had in the region. I'm kind of fascinated by how these networks were really opposed to negritude. They'd come out, a lot of the writers that write for these journals write attacks on negritude early on. Which is just kind of interesting because of Césaire's, again, complicated history with communism.
What's your thumbnail definition of negritude?
A form of writing that came out of Africa, French African writers that, you know, had close ties with surrealism.
And that promoted a kind of, would you say, pan-African sensibility?
Yeah, definitely. A pan-African sensibility, a kind of return to kind of African values. There's some beautiful work that was written in it.
So we, Juliana Spahr, who is my guest in studio, who is author of the new book, Du Bois' Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment, we have focused on only one chapter of your new book. I wonder what else, and I know that's hard to condense your arguments, but what else can people find in this volume?
I do a chapter on the late 60s, early 1970s, and literature's role in kind of like cultural resistance movements, and turn from the CIA to the FBI, you know, kind of tracing a kind of similar kind of government attempt to contain these movements through a form of funding at various moments, through at moments offering funding, at moments withdrawing it. and often using it in particular to kind of like, you know, when they have moments, when they're anxious that a riot's going to happen, they will often, or that there's a group that suddenly is kind of like in dialogue with the Black Panthers, they will often put a lot of cultural funding into those groups at that moment. And then I turned from there to like the 1990s, which is where I started, you know, trying to think about this kind of literature that I kind of see as potentially a literature that could be resistant, that uses other, that has, you know, political concerns, that uses kind of other languages, which are some of the kind of like markers by which we tend to see resistant literature, and how it stays very firmly in the kind of as a form of literature and not as a form of politics. And I try to kind of understand that through, you know, various forms of governmental support that the government has offered over the years, like as a remnant of that history that I kind of traced earlier.
And your first chapter is partly about writers from various locales who wrote books in English that included other languages.
Well, I'm interested in that because that's one of the ways that writers try to not be nationalist writers, to try to not write in the language of the nation state. And so it's a move often that a writer has a politics that they want to, it's one of the ways that they show that they have a political intention to not be the kind of governmental writer. And so I was interested in that.
Is it your sense that there's a kind of common sense belief that literature tends to be independent from politics, that, you know, writers of fiction and of poetry, that they are kind of stand apart from politics, are less likely to be influenced by that? And do you see your book as maybe a corrective to that?
I mean, that's been one of the ways that you could recognize a kind of establishment writer, is that they would say that, you know, that there was no politics to writing, and they would try to separate it out in some way. I mean, I kind of feel like that we're seeing a moment when that the fact that you could claim that has become less obvious in some way or less possible. And there's a kind of awareness that even a literature that avoids political content has a kind of politics to it. I guess I'm probably part of that trend to try to stop thinking that anyone could ever write in apolitical literature.
Juliana Spahr, author of 8 volumes of poetry and of the new book Du Bois's Telegram, Literary Resistance and State Containment. She is professor of English at Mills College. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.